Welcome to Recovering Evangelicals, a podcast for people who were once very comfortable in the Christian faith until the 21st century intruded and made it very hard to keep on believing. I'm your host, Luke Jansen.
And I'm Scott Dyer.
Last week, we talked to Dr. Joel Anderson about his experience as an educator within the evangelical school system, as a teacher at the high school and college levels. Today, we're going to talk to another Dr. Joel, this time Dr. Joel Duff, who is also an educator at the university level, though not in a strictly speaking evangelical institution. Instead, Joel Duff is a professor and researcher in a secular state university, but a very large proportion of his students come from the evangelical world, from the Bible Belt of the U.S., and Joel is very open about his own evangelical faith, so they bring their evangelical worldview and questions and angst to him. But more importantly, Joel Duff has built a major online presence. He's a prominent figure in the blogosphere, with his blog site called Naturalis Historia, which then grew into a YouTube channel, and he's often engaging online with people in the evangelical world, posting comments, asking questions, and providing qualified first-hand expertise, and speaking at evangelical churches, schools, and high schools. And the primary focus of his work here is Ken Ham and Answers in Genesis. He's been watching them for over a decade, and if there's any arm's-length expert on that topic, Dr. Joel Duff is one. We've had him come onto the podcast twice before, 2 years ago in episode number 68, when he talked about some major changes happening at the leadership level within the young earth creationist world, and before that in episode number 26, when he talked about how his Christian faith was threatened not by science, but by young earth creationism itself. You'll need to go back to that episode if you want to know how that happened, or almost happened. But you should also go back to that episode, again, number 26, to hear the full version of Joel's life story and academic accomplishments. We won't repeat that again here, but it's enough to say that he's a professor at the University of Akron, Ohio, is a biologist and does externally funded research there, so he knows what he's talking about. And we have him here right now. Dr. Duff, welcome to our podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Or can we call you Joel?
Joel's fine.
Joel, you have been on a podcast before, in fact, twice, and your second conversation with us reached the highest number of lifetime audio file downloads that we had out of all of our episodes produced in this podcast. I think we need to give you an award or a prize or something.
Wow, I had no idea. Well, let's hope for better on the third try.
We'll see. And for the listeners, that was the conversation we had with Dr. Duff in the beginning of 2022. Joel, you told us then about a bit of a shakeup or a shakedown happening in the young earth creationist world, what was looking at that time like a transitional change in the leadership of that movement. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, but first, I want to finish introducing you to our audience. Many of our listeners will already know about you, mostly through your many blog posts and your YouTube channel.
Yeah, that's the new thing since I talked to you last, is starting the YouTube channel.
Right.
And it's been a really intellectually invigorating experience. It's a new audience. I had no idea that the blog audience is very different than the YouTube audience, just like the podcast audience is different, which is why I really appreciate being able to talk to you, is because you have a podcast audience, which also hits people that may not know me.
Well, kudos. Well done.
Yeah.
So I'm going to steer our listeners to a more lengthy introduction to you, your credentials, where you're at now. We covered that in quite a bit of detail in episode number 26. And so again, I'll defer the listeners over to that to find out about that. But maybe, Julie, you can give us a thumbnail sketch of who you are now, your career, again, your hobby as a YouTuber and blogger, and the kind of Christianity that you identify with.
Yes. So, yeah, great question. I've been thinking a lot about my identity lately. I started a new blog post about myself, or a new website called joelduff.org. And I wanted to kind of identify who I am as a Christian, because people mostly know me as biology professor or young earth creationist critic, right? On the YouTube channel, on my blog, it's often about like, what do I know about science? I'm criticizing young earth creationism, but I've been thinking about my identity as sort of like, what do I really want to accomplish? And it's not just criticizing, it's providing a competent solution or response or another way of moving forward versus just here's what's wrong. And so, and I also wanted to say, here's my theological credentials, right?
Right.
I grew up here's my theological background, and not just my background, but who I still am today. And that is, I mostly identify as sort of the Reformed theological tradition. But on that website, joelduff.org, I sort of identify the particular strains of thought, because I know that even just using the word reform these days, you know, brings a lot of connotations in a lot of people's minds, and there's a lot of different strains within that. And I kind of fall within one particular one. But that's something that I've been really wrangling with lately, is sort of the identification who I am and what makes me really tick, you know, how I view the world. And then taking my science and what I've learned about this world as a Christian looking at the world through those scientific lenses, how does that, as the whole package, sort of say what it is that I'm doing and why I'm doing it? And I think one of the questions you're probably going to be asking me is, you know, why do I spend so much time on this type of stuff? Well, I'll say it looks like an obsession from the outside, I'm sure.
Well, I appreciate it. You've got some great material out there. We're going to have some links in our show notes for your blog site, for your YouTube channel, and I recommend people look at it. You've got some great stuff there. Joel, you've had one primary target in the crosshairs of your posts over the many years, and that's young earth creationism in general, and maybe perhaps even Answers in Genesis in particular. Why are you watching them so closely?
Well, I watch Answers in Genesis so closely in particular. Well, let's just start with the broader question of young earth creationism. In my upbringing, I've been around and am around still within the church, you know, have close friends and family that are young earth creationists. So that's sort of the personal angle in terms of wanting to have conversation and reflection with those that I know personally in terms of shaping our beliefs. And then that has sort of taken off to an extension of, okay, well, here's something that I think that I've been gifted to know, right? I'm in this area of science and I can bring a unique perspective maybe to the Christian church. And so that has led me to talking more broadly about young earth creationism to a larger audience. But Answers in Genesis, I mean, the primary reason to talk about Answers in Genesis is because they are the 10-ton gorilla in the young earth creationist game. I mean, they're the ones they're the movers and drivers, and chances are whatever they are going to say or whatever position they take on any particular piece of evidence or any, now these days, any cultural artifact or interest that they have, that's going to propagate out to all the other young earth creationist ministries in a way. They either have to agree with Answers in Genesis or they have to make some cogent argument about why Answers in Genesis is wrong, which is difficult because if they do so or try to do so, chances are they may lose some of their own followers. So they are the mover and shaker of young earth creationism. And so that's sort of what you have to deal with. You have to deal with them in order to have an influence on the whole movement itself.
You referred to them as the 10-tongued gorilla. In preparing for this interview, I wanted to find out a bit more about their business, their profile. And I found that they're not as big as secular businesses like, you know, an American bank or pharmaceutical company. But in the world of Christian publishing, they are quite a big player. I was able to get some tax filings. I don't know if you've done this, Joel, but I was just interested to see how big are they. Their annual revenue in their latest tax filing was $62 million, which is three times as much as Eerdmans Publishing and almost as much as Zondervan's. And wow, They've got twice that much, $112 million wrapped up in assets. Joel, I don't know if you've been to the Creation Museum or the Ark Encounter.
Been to both.
Do tell.
You're right. Those are large numbers. And I think that even doesn't even belie the fact that they have some private money on the side that doesn't show up in those 1099s or 1080s or whatever the financial forms are. They seem to have some deep pockets behind them now. They purchased that $30 or $40 million new building from Toyota Corporation right there off the freeway just south of Cincinnati. And as far as we can tell, paid cash for that. And that's their new location of operations. They're building a multimedia empire. You know, they're building an alternative to the media of the rest of the world, right? So you can not just get your Answers in Genesis from about science, but you'll get your answers about everything. Yeah. Right? It's going to be, you know, video, it's going to be social media. It's going to be, well, I've been thinking a lot about AI search vehicles. You know, what people would say is the bias of ChatGPT or something like that, and giving response that are anti-creationist. Well, I suspect what Angels and Genesis is going to do, they'll take their whole corpus of all their material and they will train their own, sub AI and make a search vehicle, which will be Christian safe, right? That you can enter and you'll get all your responses that will be fed to you from Angels and Genesis. And that's just the next step in sort of creating the newest silo or isolation of the Answers in Genesis world and their followers, allowing them to basically create a subculture in the country.
You've heard hints of this, or this is just something you can see happening?
That's my speculation. Right. And there's some smart people there marketing wise. That's one of the things they do well. And they have a new CEO, Martin Iles, who's pretty sharp that way. I think he has big, big ambitions for Answers in Genesis, way beyond. I mean, he has no interest in creation science as sort of the origins of young earth creationism and, well, of Answers in Genesis and ICR and Creation Ministries International. They're ministries that are meant to help Christians understand how to answer scientific questions within the context of a young earth interpretation of scriptures. But that's not what Martin Iles views Answers in Genesis role. They're way beyond that. That's just a door. People's questions about dinosaurs are just a way to kind of get them into the front door. And then, well, we have the answers to all the rest of your questions.
Where does the Institute for Creation Research fit into this picture? What's the relationship with Answers in Genesis?
Well, I'd say no relationship with them in the sense of any meaningful interaction between those two organizations. In fact, I think ICR is on the outside looking in. They have undergone a number of different sort of iterations of presidents and different missions. They still try to maintain we're the Creation Research Institute, or Creation Research Place, where we're doing projects and we're trying to provide what I think of it as provide the foundational or basic knowledge for creation science. It's like, and then Answers in Genesis is not really about generating new answers or new information or new research. They're about packaging and promoting and pushing out, the young earth creationist message along with everything else. And so they kind of in a sense rely on ICR to do some of that research. Unfortunately for them and for ICR, ICR has taken some very different directions in terms of some of their answers.
Well,
they're blazing new paths in terms of, sort of denying the role of natural selection in the process of adaptation. And that's something that Answers in Genesis is quite comfortable with. So they're taking some, I think one of their strategies is we are never going to be able to be Answers in Genesis. And they're basically taking all the donation dollars. And therefore we need to be different. And part of being different is actually providing different answers to some of these questions and making ourselves distinctive that way. And I'm not sure that strategy will work. It'll either work and it'll be successful, or it'll be the complete undoing of Institute for Creation Research.
It's kind of interesting how, I mean, you got to give Ken Ham credit, I think, for being a marketing genius and a media savvy, because it's just interesting. In my younger days, ICR was they were the group.
Absolutely.
And all of a sudden, this obscure Australian comes along and eclipses everybody.
I mean, he comes to ICR, and then he just like one day he jumps ship from them and says, I'm going to start my own thing and move away from California to some no place in Kentucky, which had cheap land, and he built an empire there.
What was your impression of the quality, aside from all the the issues with the ARC experience and stuff like that? What about just the general quality of the?
Oh, Ken Ham is a marketing marvel in that sense, that the quality of the exhibits themselves, right? The experience there is quite good, right? The grounds are beautiful. The displays are world-class. Ken Ham is not exaggerating when he says that we have world-class exhibits in the sense of LED displays and 3D animation. And I mean, they spared no expense, right? To create that experience.
Yeah.
And when I've been there and what I do when I go there is of course I'm looking at all the displays and I'm taking notes and I've got pictures of everything, but I'm also there to sort of feel the ambiance of like, how do people react? I just get in one place and I listen to kids and adults. What are they thinking and saying to their children as they're looking at these displays and trying to explain them to their children? and what's their overall experience? And their overall experience is this is as good as going to the Smithsonian, or, you know, better in most of their minds because they believe the content is better. But they also have this like in awe of just the overall feeling of being there.
Right.
So it is a, it's well done.
Mm. I want to bring us back to the financial numbers, but stay on this point here. So I mentioned how I looked at some tax filings and I very quickly just went through some previous years. And what I noticed was there was a trend that basically their revenues were $10 or $20 million above expenses. So every year there's another $10 or $20 million that goes into the bank. And I was jokingly going to ask Joel if you thought, okay, are they going to buy up some more land and build something like a Tower of Babel or something? But but then here's my point that I'm serious about. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that anybody's pocketing the money. That's not where I'm going with this.
But they are building a Tower of Babel, you know.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Oh, you mean there is such a... Oh, tell us about that. Yeah. And I'll finish my point.
Yeah, tell us about that. Yeah.
Oh, you want me to elaborate on that, the thing I just dropped on you?
Yeah,
sure, if you don't mind. I thought it was a joke, but no, go ahead.
Well, no, that is part of the continuing plans for the Ark Encounter property. Right now, they're building a recreation of Jerusalem. It's a mini version, but it's massive in terms of the scale. It's in one big, large building. But then there have been plans actually since the beginning to build a Tower of Babel type thing. And it would be dedicated to the origin of languages, would be kind of the excuse around it. I think it's good. The irony of it, of course, is building the Tower of Babel. I mean, that's like the best connotation. Like, yeah. They didn't get it done, so we're going to do it. You know, let's build this tower. But, you know, in their minds, it's a way of saying here was what was wrong with the Tower of Babel, but here's what God accomplished through the destruction of the Tower of Babel. And whether it actually happens or not, they've had a lot of plans and some of them have happened, but it's aspirational. But I tend to think that at this point, that's probably one of the next steps because, you know, the way amusement parks work is, and it is in a sense an amusement park at this point, is that you have to keep adding attractions. Because there's a limited pool of people, let's face it. Like, not everybody's gonna, you know, want to go to the Ark Encounter. So in order to get people to come back, you've got to add another attraction so there's something new to see the next time you come. And so it's a little bit of a dangerous situation you're in because you have to constantly build out, which means your infrastructure costs increase. And if you don't continue to grow your audience, they can all come collapsing down. And we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Okay. Now here's where I was going with that point. Again, I found that they for many years they'll have $10 or $20 million extra, which I presume goes into a bank. And so my point was going to be that for such a large organization that's shaping the education of so many people around the world, I'm often struck by the fact that they don't have a lot of qualified experts to be saying the things that they do talk about, and they'll even ignore the expertise that's available out there. Their experts don't debate qualified experts in any given area, other than I was talking to Scott earlier about the Ken Ham, Bill Nye debate. I don't know, did you see that one, Joel?
Oh, yeah. I was attuned to that very closely, but I was exceptionally frustrated. I knew that was going to be a disaster from the beginning because, as you're going to say, neither of them are experts. And even Bill Nye is not really an expert in most of the things that he talked about. He certainly is no expert on young earth creationism. And therefore didn't understand his enemy, right? In terms of how to talk to him.
But here's where my point was going then, that they have a lot of money on hand. They don't have a lot of experts. They don't really get expertise in. And that was my point. Why can't they hire, if they really believe what they do, why can't they hire some good qualified experts to make what they would say are good qualified arguments for what they'll teach?
Well, you're assuming there's experts out there that would have the ability to answer those questions.
I'm not assuming that. That's basically the question. Are there such experts that can really speak towards those points?
But I do think that there are the other young earth creationists who are better spoken, more understand the issues better than most at Answers in Genesis, or understand the science and even understand theological questions there. But they also don't agree with everything that Answers in Genesis says. And I think most importantly, they don't really agree with the apologetic method of Answers in Genesis, which is kind of a throw it down and we're super confident in everything. And we're just going to say this is the truth. And there are other young earth creationists, well, like Todd Wood and others that are out there on the fringe that will acknowledge that, you know, the evidence doesn't all look like the world is young. And, you know, they would say, I'm still theologically committed to a young earth, but I understand that we're way behind and the evidence doesn't look good for us just on the face of it. But we believe in the long run, we'll be able to develop models. But that's not Ken Ham's approach. Ken Ham's approach is everything does look like it's young. You simply don't have to make worldview glasses on. And if you did, everything would point to the right answer. And besides, we have all the answers. You know, that's why they don't do much more research, is we've got the answers. Just buy answers version 1, 2, and 3 of the book.
Getting back to your point that there are some good qualified thinking people, unfortunately, they just have they're wearing these glasses when they speak. You've got this great story about how they don't seem to recognize the problems in their own ideology. They're happy to just go on ignoring it. So this story of, and I'll let you tell the story, but just to set the stage, a story from a colleague, Jay Johnson, who took one of the articles that Answers in Genesis wrote about flat earthers. And I think what they were trying to do is to shift the focus off of them onto another group and, you know, get the spotlight off of them, make themselves look like the scientifically enlightened ones. And so this article ridiculed flat earthers, made flat earthers look really foolish for their backward thinking. But then Jay Johnson did something to turn the tables on them, and you can tell the story.
Yeah, I remember he posted that on a Facebook at some point where he took the actual Answers in Genesis article written by, I think it was Danny Faulkner, who's their astrophysicist or astronomer, and took his wording and simply replaced flat earth with a young earth and a young age. And I can't remember off the top of my head the words replaced.
I'll jump in and then I'd like you to continue. So they replaced flat with young. He replaced shape with age. He replaced sphere with old and globe with old and astronomy with geology.
All right. I'm glad you have that in front of you. I meant to look up before we got on here, because that is as one of my favorite posts that he allowed me to actually place on my blog as well. I'd asked him, like, this is a great story. You know, this needs to get out a little bit more. But the gist of it is, if you replace those words, it still reads very naturally, except that it reads naturally as an exceptional argument against a young earth.
Right.
You know, and so all the same tools, the same logical arguments and the same rhetorical arguments even that you can use against a flat earth also work as an argument against a young earth. And so this is a young earth, you know, young age creationists really have a problem with is that their followers are very likely to fall and trip down the path to a flat earth. Because the same exact arguments can be used to convince them of that. Yeah, both from the scriptures and from basically that the world around us is a big, well, it's a whole conspiracy that we're being told that this world's round when it's really flat. And you have to do that for a young earth, right? You know, the world, everyone's telling you that it's not young and there's all these reasons why it's old.
Exactly. It was a great article. And again, I'll have the listeners go to it. We'll provide links. But Joel, I'm curious, did they ever respond to Jay Johnson's post?
No, I've never seen any response to that.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
But it must be frustrating for you as a scientist. You actually work with biology, with biological specimens. You do use techniques that will date the specimens, or at least you have people do it for you. And then you actually work a lot with the genetics. So it must be frustrating for you to hear them speaking on things that they only read about and then critique those things and show what they think are problems, misinterpretations, contradictions, but they don't do the stuff and you do. So tell us about that frustration.
Yeah, I mean, right. There are days when I'm very frustrated. I constantly come back and tell myself, okay, there's two levels of frustration. There's the frustration of the average person, right, in the pew, or somebody who doesn't know any science, who then is hearing that material. It's kind of like social media today. You can post anything on social media. You can say anything you want. And people, if they already are predisposed to believing or want to believe it, just suck it up, right? And that's what the average person in the pew who might be told, like, this is, you know, these are experts and they know what they're talking about. I'm frustrated that it's very difficult to talk to those individuals because they have great faith in their leaders. And that's where my frustration is really aimed, is not individuals I meet every day and see on social media or my friends who hear these stories, you know, they can be wrong, but they're wrong in a more innocent way. What I'm frustrated with are the leaders of young earth creationism that should know better and should have enough expertise to be able to discern a good argument from one that's not as good. And even Answers in Genesis has, they used to actually identify bad arguments that other people were making. I mean, well, like this geocentricity thing is something they had to deal with. But in a way, it's like anything that gets somebody pointed toward a young earth, whether it's a good piece of evidence or not, is still kind of okay in their minds, because ultimately it is the truth, right? In their minds, a young earth is the truth. And sure, there's a Karl Baugh and there's some other characters out there that are promoting like footprints of humans and dinosaurs and rocks that we think are probably not really real. You know, it's like, those are not very good arguments, but we're not going to stop people from using those, because at the end of the day, again, it is a young earth. And that particular piece of evidence might not be the best piece of evidence, but if it can continue to point people toward feeling like, yes, there is evidence to support my view, then that's still a good thing. And I that offends me really as a Christian who wants to feel like I want to have true arguments. I want to be faithful to evidence that God has given us in this world. To me, it smacks of more like what politics are today, you know, that whatever gets you to a point of getting that vote is important, because, well, if I get that vote and I'm in power, then I can do good things. So even if I have to lie to you to get that vote, it's still for the good. And I think that kind of logic has seeped down into a lot of these movements where you have very powerful people who in a way are at a point where they can't really be self-reflective. I mean, honestly, can Ken Ham really self-reflect and say, yeah, I might've been wrong about this interpretation of scriptures? Because then your whole worldview is going to collapse. And your whole family is dependent on that income. I mean, this isn't just for Christian organizations. It happens all around us in the world, where once enough people, once there's enough, what do you call it? It's enough
critical mass.
Yeah. Critical mass. Right. It's hard to change direction. It's a paradigm shift. Yes. It's hard to make a paradigm shift. And young earth creationism is just moving forward, and it has such a critical mass of enough individuals, enough people, enough money that it can't fail. You know, no matter what other little piece of evidence you throw out, even if it seems like a really significant piece of evidence, it can't be allowed to fail. You just simply have to keep moving forward.
So you talk about this massive entity, young earth creationism. Why was it introduced? Why did it become so popular?
Well, the idea that you could use a scientific explanation to show the world was young probably goes back several hundred years, because you go back to the very first inkling that the world is old, and that's where you have to have the first arguments that the world is young. You know, before that, you really is a question. It's not something you have to think about. But nonetheless, even when you get into the 1800s, most of the church has sort of accepted an old earth. It's not until you hit the early 1900s that you end up with a few individuals, especially from the Seventh-day Adventist, who are saying that, no, this biblical interpretation of six-day creation is critical. And we can show scientifically that the world is young. And that kind of gets things going again. But you have to get, but your question really is, well, why?
I mean, yes,
why,
exactly.
If it's kind of disappeared, why is it coming back?
Right.
And I think that really goes back to this. I've been doing a lot of reading on this lately, the fundamentalist modernist controversy of the early 1900s. You have the Scopes trial in 1925, and that is really the focal point where modernism, which is starting to sort of deny the authority of scripture, sort of progressive, and feels like it's eroding the scriptural norms at the time. And you combine that with World War II, you know, everything seems to be not that rosy, whereas it's like, you know, the world's getting better. Well, no, the world's actually a pretty crappy place. And you have, you also have the eschatology of dispensationalism, which is, you know, the world's kind of running down and we're just kind of waiting to be captured out of this. Now, all that doesn't really exactly sound like scientific creationism, but creation science comes out of this authority. You know, you hear Ken Ham say it all the time. It's about the authority of scripture. And his mind, if you deny this interpretation of Scripture, which he thinks is the authority of Scripture, then everything else is lost, right? And he would say, you go back in the early 1900s, you know, the modernist won, and you ended up with fundamentalist, and he is the product of fundamentalism. But even fundamentalists during that day weren't all about a young earth. But what happened was it was a cultural shift, a skepticism of seminaries, of education, of science, right? And you get this increasing skepticism, and you get sort of this grassroots fundamentalism that's like, you know, more of a populism of like, yes, we believe in the Bible just as it was written, as it says, you know, and then the average, any old person can pick up the Bible and just look at it and know that's what the truth is. And so it becomes this cultural moment where now, and that's why Ken Ham, I think, really has picked up on this as his huge success, is that he catches that vibe of the individuals in church that feel like, oh, the world is becoming more, you know, everything today is, it's the same language. As I read about the 1920s, it's like reading about right now, what people are saying about like, oh, you know, it's, nothing could be worse than right now. You know, the church is falling apart. We don't have any control. You know, there's all these social issues that are out of control. That's the same way they talked back then. And Ken Ham's using that same kind of like, if we just had the authority of Scripture, right, we'd be able to rein in all this social problems that we have, bring it back to the church, and we would then therefore go back to a better time.
Right.
Sounds like Christian nationalism is.
yeah.
In fairness, during the rise of 19th century liberalism and early 20th century and so on, there was a linkage in there. Darwinism and modern literary criticism, the German, you know, theologians adopting right, yeah. the Wellhausen hypothesis.
The Wellhausen hypothesis is a 19th century idea which basically says that the first books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and maybe even Joshua, were not written completely by Moses, but actually by different authors, several different groups of people over a long period of time. So it essentially argues against the idea that God whispered into the ears of Moses.
And things like that. The liberals also linked their arguments to science. And it seems to me that the fundamentalists saw that and said, oh, well, I guess science is the problem, so we'll attack the science. And so they're both arguing about science when, in my mind at least, I'm curious what you think about this, that's not the problem. It's not the science. It's how you're using the science, and it's what you are extrapolating from the science. That's where the problem really lies.
I like that. And I also think about, well, in a way that Ken Ham is a cultural descendant of some of the fundamentals of that time. But, you know, when I go back there and I think about my own tradition being in the Reformed faith, and I think about Worf, really, they're the ones that are writing about how, okay, we don't like Darwinism as a philosophy, but you know, the idea of organisms changing or that the earth is old was not really a question for them at all. God could have made it this way. And so some of those original thinkers who are on the side of the authority of Scripture, just like Ken Ham would be saying today, you know, inerrancy and all, I mean, they would be conservative. And yet they did not have a problem with science of the day. Then when science becomes philosophy, right? And so somehow in the 1920s, then that kind of gets lost, right? I think those conservatives lose that the message there. And eventually those other fundamentalists end up winning the day in terms of like, here's what we mean by the word of Scripture. And it gets tied to particular views of origins and so forth, other doctrines. And that's carried through all the way today. We still have those divisions.
Yeah.
Joel, I'm curious if young earth creationism as a movement, if it's growing. I know it's already very big. I mean, Pew will say, for example, that half of Americans think that humans have always existed in their present form since the beginning of time. So clearly there it's a big movement. But the question is it getting bigger or is it dying out?
I think you might have asked this to me a couple of years ago, and I'm starting to wonder whether my answer might be different. I've waffled both directions on that because it kind of depends on what you mean by a young earth creationist. I think some of the research suggests that there are fewer and fewer and fewer Americans today that would, you know, when they say like, you know, what where what are our origins, you know, from Adam and Eve or something like that. Those numbers are going down, right? And it looks like young earth creationism is on the decline if they're the ones influencing the answers to those questions. And I do think there might be fewer in totality of young earth creation, or those who would stake their young earth creationists. But the fervor of young earth creationism hasn't really declined. And now that we have this ability to kind of silo ourselves, even though we're in an age of the World Wide Web and social media, and we have access to everything, it doesn't, I think we can all understand that we're also more isolated than we were. We can find the information we want to find. And that's why I've been putting a big emphasis, Eve, I've already said it before, that Answers in Genesis sees this as how to create a subculture even within Christianity to make sure to maintain that purity of young earth creationism. And those that are in that know more about young earth creationism today than anybody would have in the 60s. They might have heard of that, or they might have the other preacher told them, you know, about young earth creationism, or there's this science, but they didn't know it. Today, the ones that are into it really are into it. And I think that group is larger and more outspoken. I kind of liken it to, I don't want to be too political, but like the Republican Party is shrinking in terms of the numbers that identify as real Republicans. And partly that's because they have a particular leader that has kind of like shrunk that number. Then the number of independents have increased. But the power of that group actually hasn't shrunk in a way, because the dedication, you know, in some ways has increased. And so you can still be more influential with smaller numbers. You don't have to just be increasing your total number of people who believe in young earth creationism. Honestly, the average person appeared like, yeah, I've heard of that, or I was told that, but you know, they don't think about it. Most people don't sit around and think about origins questions that much.
Do you think homeschooling is part of the problem here?
Yes, homeschooling has been a huge contributor to the advance of young earth creationism, the advance of those that are educated in young earth creationism, who have the answers, right? Who have heard the responses, not just the philosophy of like, this is the interpretation of scripture in 6 days, and there are those out there that are working on trying to explain how to understand science. No, they have the answers, right? That homeschool curriculum really provides, you know, K through 12, I'm being ensconced in these views that whole time. And that either creates individuals that are completely dedicated to that, or it drives a wedge there and they will have a real crisis of faith when they end up going to college or get out of that particular view. But the thing is, homeschooling has kind of peaked out, I think. Christian schools are a little less likely to be as strongly young earth creationist, although many are. Here in the state of Ohio, parents send their students to Christian schools and have their tuition paid by the state. And therefore, homeschooling is no longer quite the draw that it once was, because even if you thought, well, this is better for my kid, the other thing you always could say was a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, than private school. And so if private school is no longer as cheap, this is going to upset the whole apple cart with the whole educational system. And again, Answers in Genesis, I think, is right on top of this. See, they understand the trends, and they're, of course, creating, they have their own school, right? Their own K-12 school, which is growing. And I'm sure they're going to kind of franchise that at some point. They also are creating more materials than ever for Christian schools. And then biggest thing is they've created Answers Network news. Well, basically Answers, what I forget what it's called. I think it's Answers Network. It's their video platform, subscriber-based thing. And that will include courses and classes and all their video material. And that's why they bought that huge new corporate structure, because they're going to be able to film all kinds of educational materials there. And that, I think, they're looking toward the new way in which people are going to learn, which is mostly online and through these other tools.
Where are they finding educators that are willing to drink the Kool-Aid?
Well, as Luke said, they don't have a lot of like real pedagogical experts.
Yeah.
Now, I would say in the education area, they have a number of people who have, you know, masters or even a couple of PhDs in educational philosophy and so forth.
Okay.
The thing is, you can be in that field and not ever have really, you know, it's not a science, and So you can be in that field, get that kind of education, not really be threatened in terms of your beliefs. And so then you can come to work for Answers in Genesis. And it's actually most of their educators that are writing the material about science, and they have very limited knowledge of that science. There's only a few PhDs in science at Answers in Genesis, and most of them are about to retire or are retired.
We did an episode a long time ago, and I don't have the number at hand, with a person who was rising up through the ranks at Answers in Genesis. His name was David McMillan. He was just a kid in high school.
That would be episode number 31.
Wanted to educate himself. He wanted to learn about evolution so he could shoot it down. And he was going to do that under the umbrella of Answers in Genesis. But in the process of learning about evolution, he became convinced. We also did an episode, I'm sure you've heard of Paulogia. Paul ends at Paulogia. Same thing. He wanted to create a video, I think it was, an animated story, and he just needed some information about dinosaurs. And in the process of learning about dinosaurs, he had to give it up. He had to leave the whole thing behind.
Episode number 25.
So, getting at your point that they're trying to get educators, but you only get a certain breed of educators who can do the distance.
Yeah, and the two cases you just mentioned, both of them are mostly moved to an agnostic or, a non-Christian perspective, and that's and you can see the fervor in both of those individuals once they saw how much they thought they were deceived. They've put a huge amount of energy into, debunking young Earth creationism, and I'm also in that world of debunking young Earth creationism, but I very much have a heart for wanting to move people to a better understanding of scriptures and maintaining their faith.
We appreciate that.
You're talking about kids who are raised in a homeschool environment. I know of two very cases close to within my own extended family of several people who were raised in that world, went off to university, one went into engineering, one's finishing his PhD in physics, and one is now an atheist, and the other is, I think, still kind of on the journey. But there's a real, yeah, there's a bitterness, and that's a shame. And I think this kind of stuff really hurts, it hurts young people.
Yeah, unfortunately, Earth creationism doesn't give you the tools for dealing with conflict. When you're asking hard questions of yourselves, you don't have the hermeneutical tools to be able to find ways through that. There's plenty of people who have written things. You have to know where to look, but you yourself don't know how to logic your way out of, I was told all these things hung on this truth. What happens when that truth disappears? How do I move this entire edifice, all right,
Yes.
over and hanging on a different structure? Very hard to do.
Absolutely.
Joel, let's talk a little bit about some changes going on in young Earth creationism, changes at the leadership level and at the ideological, but we'll start with the leadership level. I mean, let's face it, Ken Ham, he's long been the figurehead, the face and the voice of young Earth creationism, but he's not getting any younger. And you came on to our show a couple of years ago talking about a whole new generation of leaders coming onto the scene, and you referred to them as the new creationists. That was 2 years ago. Tell us what's happened since then. What has panned out?
Yeah, so it's a couple developments. One, just going to your first point, Ken Ham is not getting younger, like many of us are, and but he has managed to find a replacement for himself. And I was quite stunned by this development. I've been thinking a long time about who within the ranks could replace Ken Ham, and I just couldn't really imagine anyone. None of his relatives, because a number of different people in his family tree that are there, and I had my eye on a couple people I thought had some potential, but none of them have the charisma, right? They don't have they're not going to be able to be Ken Ham. No one can replace Ken Ham. But he did manage to find somebody who's as much of a replacement as I could have ever imagined him being able to find, especially considering it's an Aussie. Martin Iles, who's the CEO now, sort of just came out of the blue. Now, I've heard from a few people there, well, around Answers in Genesis, that they had. That he had known him for a while, but there had been very little public knowledge of like he hadn't been to Andrew Jazz, hadn't given talks for them. He's not really a young earth creationist in any sense other than like, all right, I believe in young earth creationism because I have these particular views of the Bible, but he's a lawyer and he's from Australia. And so he has the accent. All right. And that's a crucial point to delivering material. And he is well versed in Ken Hamisms, right? phrases of Ken Ham and speaking like Ken Ham, and yet he's probably a more effective speaker because he's got a little bit more biting sense of humor, and he probably actually does have a sense of humor, and Ken Ham doesn't. And so he has quickly taken over and put in, I think, his fingerprint on Answers in Genesis, and is taking it in the direction that Ken Ham, I think, has always wanted to take it, which is more on the sort of the social warfare sort of side of things.
That's Answers in Genesis, but I was under the impression you saw a whole new generation of new leaders beyond Answers in Genesis. And we talked briefly a moment ago about ICR and the Discovery Institute. We didn't say much about them, but I don't know who the new players are, but now we're talking about who are the new leaders in that whole movement.
Yeah, so I'll leave the new creationist off for a moment. Let's just go to ICR, since we talked about them earlier. Institute for Creation Research. They have a new president, Randy Gliuza, and he is a medical PhD. And he's taken them off in a different direction from where John Morris was. So he very much is interested in doing research, creation research, but he has some very different ideas, specifically about the evils of natural selection. And he has very much been talking about how he wants to have a whole new way of thinking about how adaptation happens. And he's also an engineer. And so he has sort of an engineering approach to understanding things. And he calls it continuous environmental tracking, that organisms pre-designed or pre-developed, designed by God, be able to track their environment. And internally, they are flipping and turning on switches that God has basically given them to see thing changes in the world and then turn on programs that are already pre-programmed in them. It's very complicated, but that's a very different view than Answers in Genesis, which actually is very kind of, is very much moving down the road of, hey, it's natural selection, it's genetic drift, it's mutations, it's, you know, in the post-fall world, all this genetic variation that God gave these organisms when he created them is just allowed to play itself out. And he created organisms with the ability to adapt and change in their environments. And that's why they can speciate and do all these, basically lots of evolution without calling it evolution. But ICR is very much rebelling against that. You know, that's too much. They, Answers in Genesis has gone too far. You know, they're going down the slippery slope of just falling in place in line with the mechanisms of evolution, which makes them evolutionists.
They had this idea of this hyperspeciation, which they basically was they were trying to condense millions and millions of years of evolution into just, I think, 1,000 years after the animals got off Noah's boat. Why don't you tell us a bit about that whole idea?
Yeah, now hyperspeciation or the idea that organisms have speciated since they were created, if God created all the separate kinds, some people will say, like, well, no, the original creationists 200 years ago believed that every species was created by God. And I'm sure there were some that did believe that. But the new young earth creationism of the 20th century, even the very earliest adherents, thought that there was some speciation allowable. Like you could take one type of canine and it could become several different types of canines that we call species. And so speciation was okay. And then as people began to develop and think about, like, well, how many species or how many kinds would be on the ark, it became more apparent that you needed more species to be one kind, right? You needed to have 25 different canines all be one kind, because if they were 10 kinds, there'd be too many animals on the ark. And so out of something out of necessity, it becomes, you need to boil down all the kinds into like large groups. And that continues today. So the idea existed in the past, but now that they've thought more about the mechanisms, they've become more amenable to talking about it openly. Like just a lot more speciation happens. And now that they think of, now they had to have been forced to calculate it, it's like, oh, it has to happen really fast, like really, really fast. And so that's where we've kind of put the label on it, like hyperspeciation or hyperevolution. They're taking evolution and speeding it up 10 times. And calling that creationism. It all can be very confusing to anyone who doesn't, like, isn't in this world. Like, what is that all about? To somebody who studies and works with evolutionary biologists and does evolutionary biology research themselves, it's just astounding to think that somebody out there believes that, you know, these animals could have become 20 different species in the space of just a few years with the amount of genetic diversity that I know that they have.
Not only is there a problem with time, but I'm also thinking, like, even an un-university educated person will recognize there's a problem. I think they should, because if you condense all the dog kinds, all the canine kinds into one generic animal, and all the feline kinds into one generic animal, all the marine birds into one generic kind, there's a problem, because when these animals get off the boat, you're going to have a carnivore that gets pretty hungry. They're going to eat, you know, the marine bird kind. And so I did a little bit of very quick research before doing this. I found out, for example, a barn owl will typically eat 3 to 4 prey items per night. Well, that's 3 or 4 whole kinds of animals that are suddenly gone after one day. A wild fox is estimated to eat around 5 to 10 rodents per night. So again, lots of species are going to suddenly disappear the first night, after a week, after a month, you know. A tiger consumes about 50 deer-sized animals a year. Well, after 1 year, that's a lot of, like, thousands of species have now disappeared. It's a problem,
but Luke,
right?
But Luke, the thing, Luke, is at that point, they'll just drop the God card, that God miraculously kept them from, you know, somehow miraculously didn't allow that to happen. You know, like, that's what I, the other thing that I've heard very commonly from people, microevolution, not macroevolution, right? So no problem with microevolution, variations like we're talking about, but beyond, you know, species, no, you know. And even Michael Behe said that in our podcast, which kind of surprised me, to be honest, that he drew the line at species, you know, and said, you know, within species, but not across species. Anyway, sorry.
No, Scott, no, you said something that is something that I had on my a list of things to actually bring up, and that is a greater appeal to miracle. I mean, younger patients have for a long time been very reticent to ever try to appeal to miracle, because it seems very ad hoc. And besides, the creation is done, right? God finished creation. He doesn't need to add more elements to it. But as they've continued to work the models out, now this is always a problem with any field. You can start with big, broad ideas, big, huge ideas. But once you start to work out the details, you confront the facts, right?
Yeah.
And it becomes harder and harder and harder to explain all those different facts within your framework. And so more and more what I am seeing, and I've seen this exactly, you just mentioned it, and Luke, as you're saying about, like, what about them just eating each other after getting off the ark? I've heard miracles now being employed, like God sent different animals in different directions. So, you know, carnivores were sent off one way and with a few prey, but the other ones were preserved by sending them a different direction. Like, how did all the marsupials?
And the carnivores died.
Yeah.
The carnivore kind
well,
that died.
Well, they weren't originally carnivores right away. They could have been omnivores that then gradually became more carnivorous.
Okay.
So they ate, and besides, there's a lot of dead animals lying around on the ground after the flood, right? So they could have been scavengers originally, and then not.
Right.
Yeah.
But as you like, well, how come only marsupials, like 40 different kinds of marsupials, all end up in Australia, to the exclusion of placentals? Well, that, you know, you almost have to have a miracle there. God had to have basically directed placentals to not go across on a raft where all the marsupials did jump on the raft. And that doesn't make sense from any statistical point of view. So you have to invoke some kind of, you know, supernatural event at that point. Now that's happening more and more, like the heat problem for, like, there's just too much heat generated by volcanoes. How are you going to eliminate the heat? That's been an intractable problem. Therefore, God just removed the heat through some mechanism we don't know about, but just by miracle. And so there's a new sort of, like, we're just going to constantly add more miracles in as we go.
Okay.
But Luke, also, one of the things that did happen after the flood, according to Young Earth creationists, is that 50% of all the kinds did disappear. They did go extinct. Like all the different dinosaur kinds, all the different synapsid kinds, there's like 80 different kinds of synapsids, which don't exist, but they had to have been on the ark. There's pterodactyls or pterosaurs. There's like 25 different kinds of pterosaurs. So that's a lot of kinds that somehow just disappeared. And the Young Earth creationist argument for that is that, yeah, some of them just got, you know, scarfed up right after the ark. I mean, before they managed to populate, or they just weren't adapted for the new world.
The more I listen to this conversation, the more I'm thinking the flat earthers might be more sane. they, you know, like, come on. Like, it's just unbelievable. Like you said, I really like what you said there about digging into the details, because when you talk at that macro level, you don't think about those things, right? But when you get down into the details of, well, how did Noah put pterosaurs on the ark? You know, like when you really, it just becomes so much more fantastical that you realize that it's absurd, really.
That's why I like in my videos to just go to an article then go to a specific site and look at the specific fossils that they found in this particular layer. And then ask questions about that particular thing, not just in general, how could you make movements in the fossil record? Young Earth creationists have a response to that. How would you make this particular footprint? Because then you have to invoke a particular set of circumstances or particular set or order of events that would have occurred. But Luke, let's get back to your question about, you know, the leadership, like, you know, where are things going? Because, you know, I was talking about Randy Guliuz, and I think we started talking about ICR there and some of their differences. And I think that's significant that there's sort of these two groups that have sort of different ideas on how to answer some questions. But at the end of the day, they act the same way. They have the same apologetic mission. They have the same kind of approach to things generally. I think of what I call the new creationist, and I still think that's a reasonable title for them. There's a number of, I'll call them more intellectual young earth creationists that actually live in the world of academia, like professors at Liberty University or other Christian colleges that are actually engaged in doing research. They go to meetings, they talk about these hard topics in class, but they're not as dogmatic. They're, you know, they have their students actually read literature that is contrary to young earth creationism. Whereas Ken Ham's approach is, don't let the devil enter your ears. And so do not even listen, right? He wouldn't have a conversation with me or anyone else about the evidence, right? It's you just isolate yourself from that world because we already know where we're. These young earth creationists recognize that that's not the right approach for converting, right? That's not an apologetic approach that goes out into the world and is going to be a convincing method of doing so. Now, I still think they're wrong and that they're wrong in their ultimate belief in the young earth, but I appreciate their approach. Now, they're not high profile because it's hard to be high profile when you have a more introspective approach. Just like politics or anything like that, the person who is the one that's bringing people together and communicating, talking about hard issues and not just telling you, here's what you need to believe, it always has a heavy lift. And these young earth creationists, they're more on the battle lines, right? They're meeting with students. They are raising what they hope are a new generation. I know several of them that are working with multiple young creationists who are in college and are doing just what we talked about earlier, trying to get people to have real credentials, who move through the system and have learned real science and are going to be able to apply it to young earth creationism. And they know that there's a danger there that some of them can be lost through that process. But they also see that they need somebody who can speak with more authority and be able to understand these issues much better, be understand the science and not just ideologues. But Luke, to your question about, like, is young earth creationism growing or not? I have definitely noticed a trend, and I've asked I have conversations with other faculty about this. Back when I came here 24 years ago, I taught a general biology class when I first came that had an evolution section in it. And I always had like a Q&A time during that. You know, you could ask me whatever. And it was always full of young earth creationist questions or related ID or something. Now, I still do that Q&A session in this evolution class. This last semester, I have 100 students. I only got like 3 questions that were at all had any interest in talking about that. And I don't think our clientele is like that different. It's just that it does feel like there's fewer and fewer of them that really think about these things. Now, that could just be a reflection on students that just don't think anymore.
Yeah.
Interested in bigger questions.
Maybe.
I was like, I'm going to become a doctor and I don't really care. So, because I know I've got students that are, you know, been brought up in homeschooling environments and so forth. They don't seem to be as adamant or as they used to like hit me with all the classic questions, like, you know, like, I'm going to stump the professor, because I call it Stump the Professor Day. Like, you know, literally, that's the name of the, I have a couple during the semester, like, try to stump me.
Yeah.
Ask me your hardest question.
Yeah.
And I like it because I don't try to, like, here's the truth. You know, I'm like, well, there's this way of thinking about it, and there's others who think this, and, you know, I give them perspectives, and, like, I'll try to answer the best I can. I'll give you what I think the typical evolutionary biologist would say. I'll give you some other perspectives.
I've seen what you just said, Joel, as well. Because when I'm trying to revise in the past, it was my blogs, but now it's this podcast. And I try to find where are the questions being asked, who's asking the questions, and what are the questions that are being asked. And back in my day, in our day, creation evolution was one of the biggest topics. We were talking about creation evolution all the time, young Earth, old Earth. I asked my son, who he would be in the 30s demographic. And he says, yeah, we don't talk about that stuff. And I ask, what are you guys talking about? And it'll be more cultural issues, you know, gender issues and societal issues, that sort of thing. But they're not talking about creation evolution or inerrancy and infallibility.
And that's why answers in Genesis, I mean, I think they were going to pivot that way anyway. But Ken Ham has more of a sense of the pulse of what people are, what Christians are concerned about. Now, part of it is he creates that pulse, right? He didn't talk about that, but in a way, he's so big that he creates the angst, and then he comes with the answer and give you the answer for that angst. He's telling you, here's what you should be concerned about. Here's how the world's falling apart. Here's what's terrible about everything. Now, here's the answers.
Yeah.
Joel, that sounds too much like a drug dealer.
Yeah.
So now we get to the part of the conversation where I ask the question, what do we do about this? How do our listeners respond to this? They will have friends and family who are young Earth creationists. They may still be attending churches that are still very young Earth creationists. And so what do we do? What do all of us do? And I don't think the answer is just giving more information back to the young Earth creationists, because they've been impervious to, you know, updated scientific facts or even updated theologies. They've been impervious to that for decades. So what can we do that's more of a productive response?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not about more data.
Right.
And we as scientists and educators have a lot of evidence that evidence doesn't convince, you know, evidence alone. I simply can't come up with my five best reasons why you're wrong from, you know, with these pieces of data, like, and then just expect somebody to throw up their hands and go like, well, you're right. I was totally wrong. And unfortunately, there's no easy way to change the, you know, it's like changing the direction of the Titanic at the last second. Everything's moving for somebody in their life. If they've been brought up in young Earth creationism, they're moving in a particular direction and there's no way to move it fast, right? It's a slight nudging. In my mind, it's really hard, but it's about personal connections. It's about one-on-one conversations. It's about being human. It's about showing that I struggle with these top questions myself. I don't have all the answers. And it's when I have many, many successes in just sitting down and talking to people and allowing them to explain like why they believe what they believe. And then you realize that most people actually do have a lot of questions. You know, they've heard Ken Ham. They're like, if you allow them to open up, if they're defensive, they're just like, you know, you're wrong. This is liberal. This is, you know, they have all the catchwords, right, to be able to defend themselves. But if you allow somebody to just speak and say what their concerns are and to share their beliefs, eventually they're like, but I don't really understand this, or, you know, that really never made sense to me. Well, I don't get this thing where like all these different species come from just like two that were on the ark. Because I look at the Bible and I see that there were different kinds of canines already mentioned in Job and other passages that are very early on. So that's, and they look, they're just like the ostrich is described just like the ostriches today. It's behaviors. It doesn't look like things have changed that much. And I say like, yeah, that's right. You know, the world that the Bible described, the authors have described a world to us that is very familiar to us. You know, all the way back to the beginning, it is describing an ecology, a landscape, a environment, like a climate that is just like we understand today, with the Nile, the flooding. That's because maybe, you know, the world might be a lot older, but for the last 10, 20,000 years, it's been very similar, right? Mm-hmm. Not much has changed. And so you might want to think about, you know, you just have little conversation starters like that, where you just feed somebody the thought that, yeah, this makes sense within the scriptures, that there isn't change. And yet, I mean, these young Earth creationists are telling me that animals must be like giving rise to other species, like popping out offspring that are completely different. Whereas the authors of scripture talk about a kind always giving rise to a kind. You know, the observation is that not like the other ancients, which believed that weird things happened and that, you know, spontaneous generation and that gods were making all kinds of things. No, God is a consistent God and his creation is consistent. Every animal you see is propagating a similar animal to itself. And you can depend on that. That's going to continue to happen because he's true to his providential laws. And that's, all these things are inconsistent with the young earth creationist view, actually. So it's little things like that. I know that's not a very satisfying answer because that, you know, that's not changing the world in a day.
No, I think in a lot of ways you're hitting on a number of really important things. And I think one of them is that, you know, nobody likes to feel stupid, right?
Yeah.
I don't, you know, none of us like to feel stupid. And I do find that a lot of the anti-creationist or whatever folks, and I understand it, in their own mind, they're going, well, how can somebody be so stupid, right? But when you're trying to have a dialogue, show some respect and recognize that it's not necessarily because people are dumb. It's because they've been, you know, fed certain things and often from, like you said, a very early childhood, which, you know, the impressions on our neural structure, you know, as we develop are very difficult to shape, right? I mean, they really are. They're physically part of us. So have some understanding for that and don't talk down, you know, and I think that helps a lot. I think one of the problems with public science is a lot of the public science advocates are very negative towards religion in general. And that's not a very welcome way to engage people. You know, I think of people like Dawkins or Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, and I like Neil deGrasse Tyson in a lot of ways, but he's very denigrating of any sort of belief beyond straight empirical scientific understanding. And that doesn't help, I don't think, you know?
No, I agree. And I try to place myself in other shoes where I say, there are things that I don't know in this world that I probably have too strong an opinion about and don't deserve that strong opinion. And it's helpful if somebody doesn't simply tell me I'm wrong, but listens to me and then works through those questions with me.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the risk of repeating what you just said, I just want to make sure the listeners catch this. So you're advocating, and I do as well, we drop the adversarial approach. We stop trying to come up with facts that will, you know, the one-line zingers that will suddenly make them see the light. Drop that approach and instead take a lot more of a gentle approach, one that asks questions and guides these people through their thinking, like not away from or out of their thinking, but through their thinking to seeing things differently.
I'll add to that. I've been also leaning on a little bit of a historical approach as well. We don't know our history and heritage. And to think about how Luther and others thought about Genesis and how they struggled with it, and to see that it's nothing new for people to have questions about how to interpret Genesis.
Yeah, right.
It's just really important for those who've been brought up in young earth creationism. They have been taught that simply this was obvious throughout all history. We're simply going back to what everyone already believed. I'd say if you went back to Augustine and so forth, you'd find out that no, that's, he struggled and he had a lot of thoughts that would not at all be in line with young earth creationists today. And so there's nothing embarrassing about saying, I just don't really understand how to balance, how to interpret this book with the science that we know today. And it's okay not to have all the answers. It's okay to not have every answer.
And I know the focus of this discussion has been on, obviously, on young earth creationism, but where do you think the ID movement fits into all this? Do you see them as, in a sense, beginning to eclipse young earth creationism, or is it kind of a parallel path they're on?
So with regards to ID, intelligent design, many people who follow me would probably recognize right away that I rarely talk about them. Like, I don't do many videos. I don't respond to sort of ID approaches. And I have a couple reasons for that. One is that I'm not overly worked up about intelligent design, but I'm not a big fan of intelligent design at all. Both theologically and scientifically, it doesn't make a lot of sense for me. But your question really is about where are they at in the world of different viewpoints on how to understand origins and creation and so forth. And I see them as a pretty small player. I see them as a very small footprint. It's just a few individuals, really, the movers and shakers. They happen to have an oversized reach because they have a couple of people behind them that have donated a lot of money. So that gives them the appearance of having influence. You know, we have a journal, we have a website, we do all these different things, and we have splashy talks and videos, but it's really being generated from a very small core. And at the end of the day, they kind of don't, in my mind, provide answers that really satisfy many large constituencies. They're kind of there to like, they kind of help out with sort of anti-evolution explanations for young earth creationists, and they're kind of there for reasons to believe, and they're kind of there for, people can take little bits and pieces of them. Like they kind of fill in a gap. Like, I don't really understand how to explain, oh, that's design, or, that's this. But it's not a holistic, like, overall, because for it's not consciously a Christian theological foundation, right? So they're a very different entity in that way. But for me, I don't see them as being a significant player, and that's why I don't pay a lot of attention to myself personally.
Okay, gentlemen, we have gone long. I think we should wrap things up. But Joel, before you go, I'm curious if you've got any things in the pipeline, any books coming. I heard that you gave a hint at a celebration next year, a big anniversary of some kind in the faith and science world.
Well, along the way, I did mention something about the Scopes trial, and I'm working on some things toward that next year. Next year is the 100th anniversary of the Scopes trial. I'm hoping to write a paper that talks about the trajectory of mostly like theistic evolution, or how Christians who aren't young earth creationists have approached the question of how to interpret Genesis from that time, 1925, to present. How has that changed or not changed in some way? So that's a big thing that's on my plate in terms of thinking. And that's been great because it's also forcing me to go back into the 1800s, early 1900s, and think about this whole topic, which is goes well beyond just like understanding science and faith, but it's also about culture and faith. And so for me, that's a big time reflection. I'm currently right now taking basically about a month off of doing any kind of blogging or making any videos. I had a kind of sudden stop in my video making. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of a time for self-reflection. Part of it is if you do this too much, you start to maybe not do it for the right reasons. And I can get a little more cynical, and I can get a little more sarcastic, and I can play things up and attack Ken Ham too much. And I'm really sitting back and asking myself, and that's why I made that website, to basically force myself to ask myself, who am I and what am I doing? How do I tell people this is who I really am? And so why am I doing it this way? What is my approach? Why am I so passionate about this? And so I'm just spending this time reflecting upon that. And so actually doing this podcast is helpful because it's like hits me right at a time when I'm really thinking about like, what are the best things for me to be doing going forward? Where should my time be placed? Because there are a thousand things that we could all be doing. And we probably all are asking that question to ourselves all the time. It's the most productive use of our time that God has given us in this world. And I'm kind of asking myself that question, but I'm also very much want to engage young earth creationists in real dialogue, because as we just mentioned a few times here already, is that bringing down those defensive barriers and saying like, how can we move the church forward? Because presume we both believe in, we both want to promote the gospel. And if there are ways in which we can drop the adversarial approach to some point where we can actually not create division within the church at a time in which there's so many other reasons why the church is dividing. This ought not to be one of the main reasons we're dividing at this time. So if I can be of any assistance in that area through the way that I talk to young earth creationists and how I deal with them, that's something I'm looking at maybe changing or moving forward with in the future.
Okay, we are really over time. Joel, you're taking a bit of a mini sabbatical. I'm looking forward to the new and improved Dr. Joel Duff and Naturalis Historia. We're going to have links in the show notes for your blog site, your YouTube sites. I understand you have a major contribution in a book, a chapter in a book, I understand.
There's a book just a few, well, it's probably 7 or 8 years ago now, Grand Canyon, Monument to an Ancient Earth. It's kind of a response to a young earth creationist book about monument to catastrophe. And it's written for, it's sort of the lay level, but it's actual geologists. I'm not a geologist, but I represent sort of the biological, some biological and paleontological perspective in that book. But that is, the approach there was pastoral. It's like, put this in the pastor's hands. It's kind of like a full-orbed explanation of like, what does the science say about the origins of the Grand Canyon? But it also addresses young earth creationism and different ideas about the world and the hermeneutics of interpreting scripture, sort of all in one package, but with a specific example, always analyzing the Grand Canyon. And it's had really great reception. And many people have been, I think, greatly affected by that book because it's written very much from a conversational sort of perspective for somebody who just doesn't know science and wants to learn, like, why do people think the world's old? And especially Christians, why do they think the world's old?
Right. And I highly recommend the book. Joel, Dr. Duff, we really appreciate you coming on again for the third time, and we look forward to the fourth time.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank Luke, Scott, great talking to you. It's always fun.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah. All the best.
Yeah, thank you.
See ya. Bye now.
You've been listening to Recovering Evangelicals with your hosts, Luke Jansen and Scott Dyer. Send your comments and suggestions for new episodes to lukejjansen@gmail.com. Join our private discussion group on Facebook by searching for the Recovering Evangelicals podcast group. Look for the logo that you always see at your favorite podcast catcher and ask to be let in. Subscribe to lukejjansen.wordpress.com if you want to get advanced releases and group posts. Or browse through our archive for a full listing of all our previous episodes. And please help the podcast by sharing with a friend and leaving a review at your favorite podcast catcher.